in the shadow of the wall today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Christian Ramirez remembers growing up in the shadow of the border wall in Southern California. He says he always had to be ready to prove he was a U.S. citizen.
And now as an adult, as a father, my child has to endure living through the indignities of having to prove his citizenship in the United States based on his last name and based on the color of his skin.
Now Ramirez is urging Congress not to build more walls. Plus, President Trump's new ambassador to the Netherlands has a tough time at his first press conference.
Why don't you answer the question? Answer the question.
This is the Netherlands. You have to answer questions.
What's that all about? We'll have the answer just ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here. We asked, you answered. Yesterday on the show, you heard a lively conversation about the Me Too movement and the backlash from French women who signed a letter saying it's gone too far.
It felt to us that through the system of social media, we had sort of an American streak of puritanism sort of invading.
This is actually part of the problem, normalizing this kind of behavior, which is sexual harassment. I'm sorry, there is no such thing as a right, the right of a man to hit on a woman.
We heard there first from Anne Elizabeth Moutet, one of the women who signed the letter, and then from Rim Sara Alouan, a French writer, who was outraged by it. We asked you to continue the discussion on the Facebook page for our Across Women's Lives project, and you spoke out for sure. We'll hear some of your insightful responses, critiques, and observations later in the show. But first, an update on DACA. That's the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program created by President Obama to provide legal status to undocumented immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children. But now their fate is up in the air. President Trump has pledged to end the DACA program, and he suggested that any deal in Congress to keep it going has to include money to expand the border wall with Mexico. There's talk of a deal in the works, but nothing's been finalized yet. Christian Ramirez grew up in the shadow of the wall between Tijuana and San Diego, where he lives today. This week, he's in Washington, lobbying for an immediate solution to the DACA crisis. I asked him how hopeful he was.
Well, it's been a roller coaster of emotions, frankly, in this past week. It started with a very difficult Monday in which it appeared that legislative solutions were at a standstill and there was no hope in sight to move those along. And then meeting at the White House with a delegation of both Democrats and Republicans from both chambers, in which President Trump opened the door for the possibility of a solution to the crisis that he created back in September. So certainly today, there's a whole lot of optimism. It's cautious optimism. We still have a long road ahead of us, but we want to make sure that we don't leave Washington, D.C. this month without a solution.
But Donald Trump has also attached conditions to some kind of iteration of an act for Dreamers. I mean, what conditions for you would be unacceptable? Do you have red lines?
We do. We want to make sure that Dreamers are not used as bargaining chips to pass anti-immigrant policies that will deport the parents of immigrant youth. We don't want to see additional deployment of Border Patrol agents into our communities. So we are making a very clear demand that the solution on Dreamers has to be a solution for them and them alone. There is a need to have a conversation. Obviously, there is a tremendous need to have a conversation about fixing the immigration system that we have in this country, making it more humane. We certainly need to get there, but the number one priority today is fixing the DREAM Act. So some of the unreasonable conditions that President Trump and other members of his party have brought forward, to us, as Washington speak for lack of action.
What are some of those unreasonable conditions for you?
Well, for instance, some Republicans have said that the only way to allow undocumented immigrant youth to remain in this country is to deport their parents, to not allow other family members to reunite in the United States, to, in essence, ban family unity. Some folks have said that the only way to move forward with a solution around the DREAM Act is to build a wall from sea to shining sea along the southern border of the United States.
Yeah, speaking of that wall, you're a U.S. citizen, but originally from Tijuana, and there's already a physical barrier there. It's a wall, and it's high, like nearly 50 feet high in some places. What was it like for you growing up in the shadow of that wall?
That's right. We have not only one wall in my community in San Diego, the San Diego-Tijuana border region, but we have up to three walls there. And growing up in the shadow of the wall meant that I, although I'm a U.S. citizen, have to carry documents with me since I can remember. If I wanted to go to play soccer at the local park, I had to be mindful that I have to have my green card or my documents with me to prove that I was a U.S. citizen. And now as an adult, as a father, my child has to endure living through the indignities of having to prove his citizenship in the United States based on his last name and based on the color of his skin. If I want to take my child to go to nearby Orange County where Disneyland is, the happiest place on earth, I have to be mindful that we are going to go to a checkpoint, a Border Patrol checkpoint, and I have to prove my legal status and my child's legal status. If I want to take my kid to visit his grandparents in a neighboring county, also in the United States, in Imperial County, I have to also go through a checkpoint. And in order to visit my in-laws and have my child visit his grandparents, we have to carry our papers. This has been the norm for generations along the southern border.
But you're a U.S. citizen, right?
Absolutely. We're all U.S. citizens. I'm a fifth generation border resident. We are all U.S. citizens, and every single member of my family, everyone who I know, all of my colleagues have had to endure the indignity of having to be searched, having to go through our personal belongings, and having to prove to U.S. federal officials who we are, despite the fact that we're not entering or leaving the country. We're simply going from one community to the next.
So just clarify something for me. Where are the Border Patrol checkpoints when you're going from San Diego up to Orange County?
Right at the county line between San Diego and Orange County, there's a checkpoint, and we have to stop.
Wow.
Agents ask us for our documents. We have to present our documents. It has happened here for generations, and frankly, we're sick and tired of it, and I want to see give our children, the next generation, an opportunity to live in our communities with peace, with dignity, and without having to endure this kind of treatment by our own government.
Donald Trump recently said that maybe what we need is a small wall. What's your reaction to that?
You know, we can't have policy just based on rhetoric. We can't one day say we need a wall from sea to shining sea, and then the next day say, well, all we need is 7 miles of wall, and then today, you know, a small wall. Policy can't be driven by rhetoric. Certainly there are some security concerns along the southern border, and we as border residents are the number one folks who are interested in making sure that our communities are safe, that we feel protected. So those are the kinds of things that we have been working with members of Congress here to make sure that we have an approach that is reasonable, that is measured, and it's not just based on rhetoric like the president has unfortunately led and other members of his party, but it's based on data and analysis, and that's what we hope to get to that finish line with common sense border policy that acknowledges the complexities of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Christian Ramirez is an activist with the Southern Border Communities Coalition. He's been in Washington, D.C. this week lobbying for the Dreamers. Christian, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Dutch wanted answers, but the new U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands didn't want to give them any. Here's what happened yesterday when Dutch reporters confronted Ambassador Peter Hoekstra. They were challenging him on statements he'd made alleging that Islamic extremists had attacked Dutch politicians.
Why don't you answer the question? Answer the question. This is not how this works, guys. Come on.
This is the Netherlands. You have to answer questions.
This is the Netherlands. You have to answer questions. The BBC's Anna Holligan is based in The Hague. So, Anna, the new U.S. ambassador appointed by Trump is Peter Hoekstra, former Republican congressman from Michigan. What else can you tell us about him?
Well, he had just been presenting his credentials to the king. You can hear a bit of that ceremony here. And then he'd headed on home to his new residence to meet these Dutch journalists. And it had been set up as a rather warm exchange. He was standing in front of a burning fire. And then it all turned rather awkward when he was once again asked to answer these questions about comments he'd made back in 2015.
Yeah, this is actually Peter Hoekstra speaking in 2015 at the David Horowitz Freedom Center.
The Islamic movement has now gotten to a point where they have put Europe into chaos. chaos in the Netherlands. There are cars being burned. There are politicians that are being burned. And yes, there are no-go zones in the Netherlands.
All right, Anna, are those statements made by Peter Hoekstra, the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands, are any of them true?
Well, this is the point, because he added fuel to the fire, as it were, because the information that he gave in 2015, there is this kind of popular right-wing narrative that extremist Islamist groups have taken over communities in parts of Europe. And last year, you might remember, one commentator on Fox News claimed that in Britain, it's not just no-go zones. There are actual cities like Birmingham that are totally Muslim, where non-Muslims right. simply don't go. And again, he was pulled up there, asked to explain his comments. There was no evidence. And the journalists in the Netherlands have been saying the only politician who has been burnt recently is actually this new U.S. ambassador, Pete Hoekstra.
So day one on the job, Ambassador Hoekstra invites the Dutch press to his new residence yesterday. And a journalist actually asked him to read the inscription over the fireplace, a quote by the second U.S. president, John Adams, essentially asking that all who reside here be honest people. Let's hear what happened next.
Did you read the quote over the fireplace from John Adams?
I have.
Well, if you're truly an honest and wise man, could you please take back the remark about burnt politicians? Or name the politician that was burned in the Netherlands. Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. I asked you a question.
Mr. Ambassador, can you mention any example?
All right, so it sounds like he didn't really answer the question, did he, Anna?
It was just so, so awkward. He just looks around the room and you have a room full of journalists asking him the same question over and over again. And I mean, he did try to take control of it again. He explained that he was hoping to focus on the future, to begin in-depth briefings with Dutch officials on the US perspectives on issues that both countries face, things like counterterrorism and cyber threats. But, you know, this early controversy doesn't bode well for the President Trump's man on a diplomatic mission in Europe.
Now, one of the reasons perhaps that the Dutch journalists were being so aggressive is that the U.S. ambassador just a few weeks ago had really aggressively denied making those comments in 2015. Here he is speaking with a Dutch journalist.
At one point, you mentioned in a debate that there are no-go zones in the Netherlands and that cars and politicians are being set on fire in the Netherlands.
I didn't say that. That is actually an incorrect statement. Yeah, we would call it fake news.
Is that
I
fake
never
news?
Said that.
Because it's what but, you but literally
I,
said.
No, it's not what I said.
Well, we know it's not fake news because we heard the tape earlier. In fairness, though, the ambassador has made some efforts to walk these statements back, right?
He has, indeed. I just have a quick look at his Twitter account, which is where he posted the statement just a few days before Christmas. He said that he regretted the exchange and that he hoped to focus on the future, wished everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. But one thing he didn't do was take back those original comments about politicians being burned and no-go zones in the Netherlands. And that's what's led to this kind of consternation. And, you know, he was born in the Netherlands. He was born in Groningen, which is in the north of the Netherlands. But his parents emigrated to the US when he was 3 years old. So this has been a rather rude reintroduction to Dutch society and the predominantly liberal press.
And when the journalists who were at the residence didn't get an answer or Hoekstra didn't take back his comments, what did they do? Did they walk out?
They didn't walk out. His press officers simply called an end to the press conference, and that was it. The fire kept on burning. The journalists remained seated. All very unusual.
Yeah, I got to say that burning fireplace was a nice homey touch, though. My colleague at the BBC, Anna Holligan, thanks so much, Anna.
You're welcome.
Coming up, how Pepsi quenches its own thirst for water. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Hurricanes, floods from winter storms, downpours and deadly landslides in California. It seems like a lot of us here in the U.S. have been dealing with way too much water recently. But in some places around the world, it's just the opposite.
The drought right now is the worst in 100 years because of climate change.
That's Patricia de Lille, the mayor of Cape Town, South Africa. Now, this is a city of 4 million people, and the mayor says if something doesn't change, the city will have to shut off water service in April. And it's not just Cape Town. Water scarcity is a growing problem around the world. So today, our Livable Planet desk brings us a look at two big companies that are taking on the challenge of water conservation. Let's start with the world's Jason Margolis.
Here's a sobering thought.
Studies have shown that as we look out to 2030, global demand for water is expected to outstrip supply by 40%.
That's Brooke Barton with Ceres, a Boston-based sustainability group. Barton says water conservation is a challenge that's just not on the radar of a lot of businesses.
It's surprising how many companies and manufacturing facilities around the world aren't even measuring how much water they use.
Ceres is trying to change that. They start by appealing to companies' self-interest. Tracking and cutting water use can save a lot of money. And Barton says that message is getting through.
What we're seeing is a growing cadre of companies who are shifting direction and elevating this as a priority in their business.
You can see some of the changes here at a massive Gatorade facility just outside of Phoenix. Ceres pointed me toward Gatorade's parent company, PepsiCo, as a leader in water conservation. The bottling lines here fill up 600 containers of Gatorade per minute.
They're doing multiple flavors. You'll see that we're doing grape, we're doing fruit punch, we're doing lemon lime.
Tim Carey directs sustainability programs for PepsiCo Beverages in North America. He says the company started investing in water efficiency 4 years ago in water-scarce Arizona. Since then, they've seen a 24% improvement.
That's about 100 million gallons of water every year that we do not use this year.
That translates into $1.5 million saved annually. Music to the ears of Carey's corporate bosses. So, how did Pepsi do it? It starts with cleaning all those empty bottles. Water is out. Air is in.
Think of it the way you would think of a air pressure device at a service station where you're filling your tires.
The pulses of air remove dust particles from sterilized bottles. Another water-saving move? More efficient filtering of the water used in our Gatorade.
Originally, we would just do a single pass through reverse osmosis. We'd use the clean water to in our operation, and the rest would go to drain.
That water is now recaptured and cleaned again, saving the company a lot of runoff. The next water-saving trick can be found on the rooftop. Carey opens a hatch, and we emerge into the bright Arizona sun.
And on top of this roof, we have a field of solar panels that covers about 700,000 square feet.
That's like 12 football fields. But just what do solar panels have to do with saving water? It goes back to the local utility. Power plants use tremendous amounts of water to generate electricity. The less power Pepsi draws from the grid, the less water is used.
And because we're all in the same watershed, we're saving water in Arizona, in the watershed that supplies us.
Which in turn helps maintain the long-term viability of Pepsi's operations here. Beyond Arizona, Pepsi has set a goal to reduce water use an additional 25% by the year 2025 at all its food and beverage facilities worldwide. Pepsi is leading the way, but what they're doing isn't exactly splitting the atom. So here's my question. Why are corporations like PepsiCo just making these changes now? Why not 25 years ago? Carey says water has long been cheap. CEOs just didn't think about sustainability as a business advantage.
People didn't say, oh, what can I do to save water? Second thing is they probably did what I call the gross stuff. They did the big water savings projects, which were fairly obvious. We're at the precision scale now where we say, how can we tune our operations? How can we buy equipment and make it operate just perfectly?
The challenges will be different for just about every plant and just about every industry. But more companies are at least asking the questions. For a look at how a very different company is trying to save water, here's Lauren Summer in San Francisco.
This team is charged with coming up with new techniques every day, like time, temperature, pressure.
Bart Seitz runs Levi's Eureka Lab near downtown San Francisco. It's a miniature factory that you might say is at the forefront of jeans technology. We're surrounded by hundreds of pairs of prototypes.
Each jean has a recipe. It's very similar to cooking.
They all start out with the same basic ingredient.
This is denim fabric that comes from one of our mills. Up until 40 years or so ago, jeans were sold like this. They were stiff and scratchy.
But what we buy today can be very different. Jeans are light, dark, faded, pre-shrunk, stonewashed. And those variations are created with water.
This is our washing area. These machines look like machines that you would see in a laundromat.
At a full-scale Levi's factory, the machines wash 300 pairs of jeans each. And to get the right color and softness, some jeans are washed over and over, which used a lot of water. But a few years ago, the company created machines that use ozone gas instead.
And it reduces the color from something dark to something light without using very much water at all.
Levi's has developed about a dozen other waterless techniques, with the goal to use them in 80% of its products by 2020. That means rolling them out to factories around the world, from Egypt to Mexico. They haven't quantified how much water they plan to save, but so far they've saved more than 200 million gallons.
To use less water is usually less expensive, especially in some areas where we produce. Water is a challenge. You know, water is a premium.
Of course, most of the water used for jeans comes from growing the cotton itself, a notoriously thirsty crop. Levi's doesn't actually grow it, but they're working on ways to cut that water demand too, including sourcing some of their fabric from the Better Cotton Initiative, which works with farmers to reduce water use. Then there's all the water that jeans use after we buy them, about a quarter of their total water footprint. And Levi's has found that we Americans use more water to wash our jeans than consumers in Europe or China.
If we could just convince people in America to wash their jeans only every 5 times they wear them, that would move the needle.
Among hardcore lovers of 501s, there is a movement to never wash your jeans, to develop a personalized patina.
It's the ultimate form of self-expression for people. I never wash my jeans, ever.
Yeah, that may not be for everyone. But washing them less, a bit easier. For The World, Lauren Sommer, San Francisco.
No, I get it, and it is confession time. I don't wash my jeans a lot. In fact, the pair I have on right now, only been washed 5 or 6 times in the past 2 years. You want to keep it authentic, right? And the more you wash your jeans, the more quickly that beautiful indigo wears out. So am I not washing for environmental reasons? I wish that were the case. I do air dry them so they don't shrink too much, but that's probably more than you need to know. And yes, on this point, I suppose I am a fashion victim. Don't judge, please. Just ahead, pre-shrunk news headlines here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A Palestinian girl is on trial after a video of her slapping an Israeli soldier went viral.
Think about it. You're doing your duty and suddenly some kid come behind you, punch you, kick you, and put a camera straight in your face.
3 perspectives on that story just ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It is a familiar headline. 2 Palestinian teenagers were killed in clashes with Israeli troops. That actually happened today. You can imagine how a headline like that ends up fueling animosities on all sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And let's face it, it's a conflict that's pretty hard to navigate. It's even hard for some people to hear stories about it without tuning out. But I think you'll find this next story worth listening to. We're going to pry apart several narratives behind one recent headline. That's a video, and maybe you've already seen it. In it, there's a Palestinian teenager confronting a couple of Israeli combat soldiers. Her name is Ahed Tamimi. She's 16. And the soldiers were patrolling outside of her family's house in the West Bank village of Nabi Saleh. The video shows Ahed hitting and kicking the soldiers, who brush her off. The video was shot on December 15th by Ahed's mother and uploaded on Facebook. Since then, it's gone viral, and Ahed Tamimi is now facing trial in an Israeli military court on a host of charges, including assault and stone throwing. But she was already pretty well known to Palestinians. Back in 2013, there was another video of her. An 11-year-old, Ahed Tamimi, was shown shaking her fist in the face of an Israeli soldier nearly twice her size. The Tamimi family themselves are pretty well known as Palestinian activists. Many in the family have been detained. A few have died in confrontations with Israeli soldiers. Reporter Dalia Hatuka is a Palestinian journalist now based in the U.S., and she's visited the village in the West Bank where Ahed lives.
The village of Nabi Saleh is a village of around 600 people dominated by members of the Tamimi family. They live next to an Israeli settlement which was built in the 70s on land confiscated from local Palestinian families. And the family home is also in Area C. Area C is the 62% of the West Bank that's under direct and exclusive Israeli control. And the Israeli military is constantly present in Nabi Saleh. And there's been many demonstrations for almost a decade there because the settlers from the nearby settlement that I just mentioned confiscated the local spring. And so the village every single Friday puts on these demonstrations, and dozens of people from the village and people, you know, from other places in the West Bank, international pro-Palestine supporters, they come and they've gone through almost a decade of just holding these demonstrations using the path of civil disobedience, because they wanted to shed a light on their village and the plight of other villages nearby. And Ahed's parents, both Bassem and Nariman, have been at the forefront of these protests. At least 140 people, if I'm not mistaken, including some 40 minors from the village, have been detained or imprisoned in the past several years. And among them are Bassem and Nariman. And so you have this child who grew up, you know, she's one of a second generation of Palestinians to be born into occupation. All she knows is basically night raids, checkpoints, verbal abuse, and, you know, the violent death of two of her family members. So this has become the norm for children like her.
And now Palestinians are holding up Ahed Tamimi as a symbol of resistance. Do a Google search on her name. You'll see she's been compared to Malala Yousafzai, even Joan of Arc. Dalia Hatuka says there's a reason for that.
I think this kind of interest in Ahed stems from the fact that she's got blonde hair and she's fair-skinned. And a lot of the times in the Western media, that becomes a face that's of interest. I haven't heard of many other children, you know, more brown children, so to speak, who are in jail and have been there for a long time. Sometimes, you know, the media picks on certain faces, but I don't think Ahed wants to be the face of resistance, irrespective of what her family says. I've had journalist colleagues who have interviewed her before, and they've all said that she likes to do normal kid things. She even mentioned one time when she grows up, she wants to be a soccer player. She really likes sports. Right. So I don't think she wants to be in that position.
Some people say the Tamimi family use their kids to push their agenda, but the Tamimis dismiss that.
Ultimately, the family doesn't believe that the fact that they put this video out there is proof that they somehow want to use their kids as props. They believe that the video was important to prove that children who grow up in that environment really don't know much other than the presence of Israeli soldiers. And these videos go viral because they're compelling in how they illustrate the underlying reality of the occupation.
Now, the name of this village, Nabi Saleh, may not seem that familiar to you, but we've actually talked about Nabi Saleh on the show a few times over the years. We've even reported on the Tamimi family. Here's a clip of Manal Tamimi, one of Ahed's relatives. It's from the summer of 2011 at one of those weekly protests that Dalia Hatuka mentioned.
Once they said in their reports in the Israeli news that the virus of Nabi Saleh should be killed in Nabi Saleh and not spread to other villages.
The plan today is the same as every Friday, to march down the main road, chant slogans, and wave Palestinian flags. The crowd makes it about 100 yards or so before the tear gas flies.
And that second voice there, that's our former Middle East correspondent Matthew Bell, and he's in the studio with me now. So Matthew, the protests in this one West Bank village have been going on for years now, but the video of 16-year-old Ahed confronting those Israeli soldiers is really getting people talking now. Why, do you think?
I think Dalia mentioned some of the reasons. It's also this, you know, it's seemingly on one hand an intractable story, but it also gets attention from around the world. You look at social media, you'll easily find lots of people posting these videos of Ahed. It really seems to have struck a nerve. It's also been reported a lot in the Israeli news media, and it seems to have sparked a conversation about a subject, you know, frankly, a lot of Israelis would like to just sort of forget about. Again, it's intractable. It's been going on for so long. You've got many Israelis who will see that video and they'll be reminded. These are people on the political left. They'll say, look, here's another example of why we need to get out of the West Bank. We need to restart the peace process. We need to do what we've been working on for all these years. But that, Marco, is not how all Israelis feel about this?
Look, when I see this video, I see a very difficult reality. You need to understand the complexity of the reality that we need to live in almost every single day.
That's Sharon Haskell. She was born in Toronto in 1984. Her father's Israeli and her mother's from Morocco. They moved to Israel when Sharon was one, and she remembers growing up in a country during the 1990s where, she says, in many ways, Jews and Arabs lived side by side in peace.
Sort of an environment where we used to go and visit on the weekends or during the week. The favorite restaurants of my father was like in Ramallah, and the favorite sweet shop is in Shechem, and we had the mechanic in Qalqilya, which is a 10-minute drive from my city, Kfar Saba.
Those were days when many Israelis felt safe visiting Palestinian towns and cities in the West Bank. Today, they can't. It's prohibited by Israeli law, for one. But Haskell says the real problem is Palestinian hatred and violence. When she was a teenager, Haskell was kind of a peacenik. She believed in the peace process. But as she got older, she moved from left to right. And her experience with the Israeli border police during the Second Palestinian Intifada helped galvanize that shift. We're talking about the early 2000s here.
I had to disperse violent demonstrations, really violent demonstrations. I had to go and do arrests of wanted people. You know, every single time you get intelligence about a suicide bombing attack, you have to open different checkpoints and things like that, check people, make sure that this person, you know, that we're looking for will not reach its destination. Because if they reach their destinations, many people will die. This is all, you know, in your hands.
Haskell says her experience in uniform helped sober her up and move past the dreams and illusions she once believed in. Today, Sharon Haskell is a member of the Israeli Knesset with Likud, the same right-wing party of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She says that she understands people will see the video of a 16-year-old Palestinian girl and call her a hero. But Haskell says it's the Israeli soldiers in videos like that one that she can empathize with.
Think about it. You're doing your duty, trying to protect and defend your people. You've got intelligence or you're under a patrol and you go around and suddenly some kid come behind you, punch you, kick you, things like that, and put a camera straight in your face. How do you deal with it? I mean, we've seen so many situations where children are being used as a human shield.
So again, Marco, this is a view from the Israeli right, but Ahed Tamimi's lawyer, for example, she has been quoted saying that this has sparked a big and important conversation in Israel. She says this has forced everyone in Israel to have an opinion about the occupation.
So what's likely to happen to Ahed Tamimi?
She's still in detention. She's facing, as you mentioned, numerous charges. These charges go back a couple of years. There's a final hearing set for January 15th. We might find out more after that. It's not clear whether Ahed will be kept in jail throughout the whole trial. We don't know how long the trial is going to last. But in the end, she could be looking at many years in prison. Here's something that I think can get confusing, Marco, and that is Ahed Tamimi is one person among something like 2.5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank under Israeli military rule. They are not Israeli citizens. So that means they're subject to a different legal system than the Jewish Israelis, for example. Tens of thousands of them live out in settlements in the West Bank, even very close to Palestinian towns and villages.
Right.
And they are Israeli citizens, so they're subject to Israeli civil law. We talked to Noah Osterreicher. She's an Israeli columnist, and she recently wrote about a case of a Jewish woman named Yifat Alkobi. She lives in the West Bank in a Jewish settlement, and Osterreicher says her case from 2010 has some striking similarities to Ahed Tamimi's case.
Yifat Alkobi is a settler from Hebron, and she was throwing rocks on a Palestinian house, and a soldier tried to stop her. Instead of just stop throwing rocks, she just slapped him across the face. And she was detained, but was released to her home after about half an hour. No consequences. And before that, she was convicted 5 times with assault and attacking police officers and soldiers. But nothing has ever happened to her. She got only community service for a month or something like that. She wasn't punished for it because the soldiers have no authority over Yifat El-Kobi. She is an Israeli citizen, so since she is not a soldier and she is not a Palestinian, whatever she does, it's a matter of civil court or criminal court. But the soldiers, they can tell her to stop. They cannot do anything other than that.
Yeah, so it's kind of a setup for a real double standard in the West Bank.
Exactly, Marco. And Osterreicher explains that the legal system for Palestinians in the West Bank works very differently from the one that Israeli citizens would be familiar with.
First of all, everything that happens in the West Bank when it comes to Palestinians who commit crimes or allegedly commit crimes, throwing stones or anything, are treated by the military court, by the IDF. Which is very different because the Palestinian lawyers need to get permission to enter the court because it's a military base. So they have to wait and they have to get permission. And sometimes they don't get any permission. So the person who has been charged with the crime don't have a lawyer for some time. And sometimes the lawyers cannot see what even the charges are because the army says it's privileged, it's classified. So the lawyers have to defend their clients without knowing exactly what they're being charged of. If a Palestinian gets into the military justice system, it's very rare for them to get out without a prison sentence because it's almost impossible to prove innocence. The fact is that there are laws for Jews and there are laws for non-Jews.
So, Marco, the story obviously is ongoing. It seems unlikely that this latest video is going to be the last one that's going to get people's attention. One of the things that struck me about this particular one is that it's kind of a test to see what your views already are about this conflict. And you can kind of project your views onto that video and people can see very different things.
Right. And it's also like Rashomon, that movie, where it all depends on which viral video of Ahed Tamimi you're watching and from what perspective. I mean, it's really complicated, just like the whole Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much for joining me for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Lots of stories we're working on for tomorrow's show for you, including this one from Haiti.
I've never chosen the easy path, and I'm not scared of challenges.
An earthquake 8 years ago wrecked the fragile economy of Haiti. This Haitian from the U.S. went back to help rebuild.
I wanted first to transform a local crop, and the second goal was to create blue-collar jobs.
She set up a production line for high-quality chocolates, and she's creating jobs where there were none. Succeeding in Haiti, that's tomorrow. Okay, back to those comments we've been getting from you about a lively discussion we had on our show yesterday. We spoke with Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, one of 100 French women who signed a letter saying the Me Too movement has gone too far, that it's become a witch hunt and pushed women into the role of victims.
What started as something that was the very good opening up of people expressing what situations they'd been put on has become a kind of social media duck pile, if you will, in which anybody can hashtag and then name somebody, shame them, and you become guilty until proven guilty, and lives and livelihoods are being destroyed that way.
Pretty much as soon as that went on air, listener comments started pouring in, and they're still coming in. Our Across Women's Lives correspondent Jasmine Garz has been responding to many of you online, and Jazz joins us now. Jazz, give us a snapshot of some of the listener reactions you've seen.
Sure. Most of our listeners were really outraged by the letter written by the French women. You know, one listener said this letter is nonsense, and she called it bizarre, a brainwashed statement. She said it's completely outside of reality. But several listeners wrote in saying they really wish there was more clarity and concrete guidelines when distinguishing between harassment and normal flirting. You know, one listener said that she and many others she knows has concerns that the Me Too movement has no definition for harassment, no parameters, and in fact, there seems to be a resistance to setting any.
Did anyone agree wholeheartedly with the letter?
We did get one listener writing in from Florida who said, reading the whole letter, she can understand the point of view. She says, you know, in the U.S., we like to put things in neat little boxes and give monikers like victim or abuser when sexuality is not so easy to define.
And yesterday in our discussion, we just started to open up the topic of class and race in the Me Too movement and how there's been this notable absence of working class women and women of color. Anybody speak about that?
Yes, we did get some great comments on this topic, and we got an interesting comment from a listener in the south of France.
Wow.
Annabelle Danner wrote in to say, "We are inclined to approve Catherine Deneuve. I work in construction, where most employed are men. And every day I hear misogynistic jokes about women, about sexuality in general. I know, and they know, that it's not a way to talk about women. So what? Should I be this angry? I'm proud to work in a field that wasn't possible for women to go into not so long ago."
Yeah, so a voice of working class women in France there. What about you, Jazz? Any comments that made you think differently about this whole conversation?
I think a really interesting comment came from one listener who said that America's roots are Puritan, and that is an energy that persists in the way sexual harassment is carried out. And I guess, Margot, I hadn't thought about it in that way, and I don't think I've heard about this analysis of the situation, that harassment in itself can be seen through the lens of Puritan culture.
Any solutions from anyone?
You know, yesterday when we spoke to our guests, they were really at odds with each other, but they were able to find this one common point, that we need to work on educating young boys about boundaries and educating young girls to feel strong enough to say no. And that is something that listeners across the board could agree on. We had actually one listener from California who said she's a middle school teacher. And she said early education among children is really important. It begins with parenting. And she said that she herself struggles with teaching young men about boundaries when there's a lot of examples in pop culture of men harassing women.
It's always great to hear what people out in Radioland think of these conversations. What did you walk away with, Jazz?
I definitely walked away with education as a priority. Margot, before I was a journalist, I was a kindergarten teacher's assistant. Mm. And I taught kids about the importance of hygiene, saying thank you, saying please, sharing, nap time. I think we could also teach kids starting at a very young age, hey, respect girls. And we can teach little girls, like, when a kid pushes you around on the playground, that doesn't mean he likes you. That means he's not being nice, and you get to say no.
Jasmine Garz is our Across Women's Lives correspondent. Thanks so much, Jazz, for watching all this and for moderating.
Thank you.
And if you missed yesterday's discussion, you can listen to it over at PRI.org. Also, keep this conversation going. Just head over to Facebook and search for Across Women's Lives. And one more note on the story. The World's Carol Hills keeps an eye on global cartoons as part of the satire beat. I asked her how French cartoonists have responded to this letter.
Well, it's interesting. The older cartoonists seem to reflect the sentiment of the letter from the French feminists, including Catherine Deneuve. And a woman is filing a complaint at a police bureau, and she points to the person behind the counter and says, "He offered me a hand." And it's a play on words of this, you know, French expression, which can be kind of, you know, he's grabbing my derriere. So the fact that the expression had the word hand in it, she's kind of saying, you can't say those things. And so this is Plantu, a very well-known French cartoonist, saying that.
Plantu is a man. The rest of the cartoonists,
men? He's a man, you know, leftist, been around since the late 60s. Mm. Then there are others who I suspect are younger cartoonists, and they are making fun of the letter. And there's a cartoon showing a man harassing a woman on the street saying, "Hey, you want to go to bed with me? Hey, babe." And she's thinking, her thought balloon is, well, maybe he really just wants to take me to dinner. And the cartoons really reflect that basic core argument that we seem to be hearing, which is, what is the difference between harassment and flirtation?
And have you seen any cartoons that actually are picking up on the image of Catherine Deneuve herself, who signed this letter?
Yes, very much so. Caricatures, but also cartoons playing on class. Mm. One of them is a woman's talking about being fondled in the subway, and Catherine Deneuve says, "Oh, what's really awful is riding the subway." and then there's another one of her, you know, some guy is making eyes at her and he's really handsome. And another guy who's not so handsome is doing the same thing. So she looks at the handsome guy and says, "You can make eyes at me." And looks at the other guy and says, "But you can't."
The World Satire editor, Carol Hills. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
And Carol will be in the host chair tomorrow. I'm on my way to New York for a few days. to hear a lot of music at the annual Global Fest. One of the artists I can't wait to check out is the one you're hearing right now. She's from Cuba. Her name is La Dame Blanche, Yaite Ramos Rodriguez, her real name, a flute player and a hip-hop force to be reckoned with. I'll be back with you next week from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
PRI, Public Radio International.